From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and the contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with D.C. Councilmember Mary Chase. She represents Ward 3, but joining us now is Will Smith. He's a member of the Maryland State Senate representing District 20 in Montgomery County. Senator Smith, thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Will Smith, the Maryland Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee met virtually this week to consider 15 policing bills, but since this is not a special session, but many progressive advocates in Maryland, as well as a few General Assembly lawmakers, I don't think you were one of them, called for a special session to address such issues like policing and other pressing issues brought on by the pandemic. Senate President Bill Ferguson and House Majority Leader Adrian Jones have said they will not call a special session. What is your position on this?
Sure. Well, thanks. We just completed 3 days of hearings on 15 bills, as you mentioned, on police reform issues, over 15 hours of testimony and public comment. And before that, I had established two working groups that were to produce recommendations and policy prescriptions so that we can deal with our housing crisis and rental assistance, and then also for our courts and our correctional facilities throughout the state. And they produced two reports there. So my position has always been that I want to put our committee in the best position to have recommendations and well-thought-out policy prescriptions if we do go into a special session or okay. When we do reconvene.
I know Tom Sherwood would have questions on that, but I omitted to mention a few very important issues that we'd like to get to. So hold your thoughts for a second while I go back to Tom Sherwood and say, Tom, Virginia Governor and First Lady Northam have both tested positive for COVID-19, and apparently they're going to sequester themselves essentially for 10 days. What happened?
Well, short answer is they've apparently gotten the virus, and they've announced it to the world. They say they don't have any significant serious symptoms. But Governor Northam was saying that this is a good example of how this virus, although some people don't want to believe it, is very real, very contagious, and that every jurisdiction in the country virtually and every citizen should be more careful. It's good news that Governor Northam is a doctor, so he kind of knows what he's talking about on some of these issues, but the point being anyone can contact this get this virus, and this is a good example to be careful with your own family.
And apparently a member of the House in the Virginia legislature tested positive. Apparently he told people in his church, but he did not tell his House colleagues, and they were, I guess, a little upset, right?
Yes, that was the legislator Thomas Wright. He's from a little town south of Richmond. He managed to tell his church, and I guess some of the people in the Republican Party, but he didn't tell House Speaker Eileen Fillercorn, who was very upset that he was away from the legislature and not doing some of the work you'd expect him to do, and he never informed the legislature. And I think that's one of the things, like for Governor Northam, if you have this virus, if you are involved in public matters, you need to both isolate yourself, as the governor is doing, and you need to contact trace and tell people with whom you've been around. This legislator didn't do that.
Our guest is Will Smith. He's a member of the Maryland State Senate representing District 20 in Montgomery County. Now back to Maryland, Tom Shore. The governor of Maryland says he opposes a pre-election vote on the Supreme Court pick, which I guess makes him not go along with a lot of the Republican leaders who approve of President Trump making that pick before the election. What's the politics here, Tom?
Well, the politics, once again, and I'd like to hear our guest, the state senator, on this, is the governor is kind of doing both-sidism, me-too-ism. He said that the Supreme Court should not be rushed in terms of who's going to be picked to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But also, he says, you know, he hasn't been critical of President Trump, who is doing a historically extraordinary effort to cast doubt on the election we're having. You know, millions of people are already voting in the November 3rd elections. Millions more will be. And President Trump, recently in the last 24 hours, is suggesting that the election is not valid. So I would like to hear the governor speak about that a little bit stronger than his soft words he's spoken so far.
And I know that you wanted to kind of follow up on the question I was posing to Senator Will Smith about the fact that people were calling for a special session to address these issues. And while we're you can go ahead and add to the question before Senator Smith continues to respond.
Okay, well, Senator Smith, first of all, thanks for coming. I did watch most of your hearing yesterday. I'll admit I watched a video version of it, so I sped through parts of it. But the District of Columbia moved fairly quickly this summer to impose some new changes on police maneuvers, chokeholds, and other matters. Virginia called a special session of the legislature to deal both with police reform matters, and they'll get to it, I hope, the budget worries out of COVID. But Maryland uniquely has decided not to call a special session. In Prince George's County, Delegate Julian Ivey has been calling every day for a special session, but the legislature, it appears, the Senate President Bill Ferguson and the House Speaker Adrian Jones, and I'm asking you, should there be a special session, whether there is one or not? Do you think there should be one?
Sure. You know, I appreciate, thank you for the question and just following up. You know, I've mentioned the steps that my committee's taken to make sure that, you know, we are in a good position whenever we reconvene to handle some of the issues that come under our jurisdiction. And I'll just say that obviously the Speaker of the House and the Senate President have come out and they've been very clear that there will not be a special session. There are several elements here that I think are worthy of consideration and a public explanation. One is that, you know, they've obviously made that difficult decision, and the situation in Virginia is kind of a telltale sign. There's a logistical issue, which is the public safety or the safety of the legislature there. And again, you know, I hope that the governor has a speedy recovery, and I read that this morning, so I was really sad to see that. But it looks like that they're coping with it well, and hopefully will recover soon. Well, so, you know, hearts and prayers out for that. Yeah. But there's the logistics, right? We've got 141 delegates, 47 senators. You've got to pack them into a chamber. You've got then committees, the committee work. So you've got to figure out how to basically isolate and socially distance from each other and what type of protocol for cleaning and sanitation you're going to have. So that takes there's some logistical hurdles there. But then also in Maryland, when we reconvene, whenever it is, we have to deal with several things right away. And that's unique from Virginia. So for instance, if we go in, let's say tomorrow, we would have to deal with our veto overrides. And there are several significant issues that the governor vetoed, like Kerwin, a fundamental restructuring and historic investment in public education that we would have to deal with right away.
Okay.
$3.4 billion.
I would also point out, excuse me for interrupting, I would point out that in Virginia, the Virginia Democrats control the House and Senate just like Maryland. But they are disagreeing on the severity of the bills they are passing. So that's interesting. But when you get done and when you get into the legislature in January, you have 15 bills before your committee about police reform. Do you anticipate introducing one singular bill, an omnibus bill, incorporating all that your committee considers, or will there be several bills? It's kind of hard to keep track.
Sure. Well, first, I'll just wrap up tidily on this one thing. We're facing a $3.4 billion deficit, so there are lots of things to consider. Also, unlike in Virginia, you know, they have a Democratic governor who will not veto their legislation, works with the legislature. That's not the situation here. We have a Republican governor that is intent on vetoing a lot of our significant legislation. So going back to the 15 bills that are before the committee that we heard this week, the idea is that they would be heard separately. Each bill will rise and fall on its own merits. But to start now so that we can start sussing out the details, have those tough discussions so that when we get back in January, we're not starting anew. We've had those discussions. We've had that public comment and input. We've talked to the academics and the experts and other legislators to get this right. I don't know. We're still very much in the midst of a pandemic, and we don't know what session's going to look like, how long it's going to last. And the last thing that I want to happen here is that we get to session, something happens, an unforeseen circumstance, and we don't get to complete the work that we desperately need to get done now. So, again, just putting our committee in the best position possible.
If Koja will allow me, I have one quick question just about the process. You did these hearings on Zoom, of course. Mm-hmm. I tuned in yesterday just in time to hear one legislator asking another legislator if that were a beer he were holding. And the legislator very quickly pointed out that, no, this is apple juice that my wife made for me. Just very, very briefly, in less than a minute maybe even, what's it like trying to do this massive work we're about to talk about, police reform, in the Zoom setting? What's it been like for you?
I'll be very quick, but we were just laughing about that last night because the feed went live before I just knew it was live. And so, yes, you're right. But it was apple juice. I can confirm that. But yes, it's surreal. You can't read the room as well. You can't understand and kind of feed off the body language. You can't have some of those conversations that you want to have. But it works, and it's going to have to work. I mean, a lot of our work in the future, in the month ahead, and frankly, media platforms or platforms like Zoom and Teams and whatever. So it's awesome. That we've made work.
There are a lot of specifics to these bills that we may not have time to go into, but you received criticism from the ACLU of Maryland, which said that the package of bills you're considering is quote-unquote insufficient. The ACLU also argues that not enough people directly impacted by the issues had a seat at the table. What would be your response to those concerns?
Well, I appreciate the criticisms of the ACLU. Look forward to working in partnership with them in the weeks and months ahead, but just saying that this, you got to start somewhere, and this was exactly it. It was a starting point. And so yesterday we had over, last week we've had over 15 hours of testimony and public comment. We're going to have a lot more, and look forward to working with the ACLU and many other groups in partnership as we develop some of the pieces of legislation ahead. But like I would just say, this is just a starting point, and we will continue to engage the public and experts and academics and other legislators as we move forward.
We're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Will Smith. He's a member of the Maryland State Senate representing District 20 in Montgomery County. We got a tweet from one listener by the Purple Line. This is ridiculous. My neighborhood has been ripped up and we've been left with only one torn up entrance / exit as they closed the other down. Construction markers block pedestrians and force them into the street for a good 20-30 feet on the east-west highway at a deadly intersection. One of the issues we'll be talking about when we come back. I'm Koja Nnamdi.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. Our guest is Will Smith. He's a member of the Maryland State Senate representing District 20 in Montgomery County. Will Smith, you heard the outrage of one of our listeners talking about it's been ridiculous about what's going on with the Purple Line. The contractors on Maryland's Purple Line connecting Montgomery and Prince George's counties are packing it up after a judge said they could leave the construction project over delays and cost overruns. Why couldn't this be avoided, and what does it mean for the project?
So obviously I'm very frustrated as well. I live in Silver Spring, so right where the Purple Line goes through, and you're right, 2.5 years of delays, $800 million of overruns. You've got $1 billion worth of construction that's left undone. And so what's gonna have to happen is the state's gonna have to take it over for a temporary period of time while they figure this out. And it's extremely frustrating. I know it's going to have a devastating impact on our local businesses, but also the quality of life for our residents. So what's going to happen is the state's going to have to play an oversized role in the short term. And then, we're going to have to figure it out and hopefully bring folks back to the table, so that we can, you know, get back on track, so to speak. But it's, you know, we've got a few more, you know, there are a few more weeks before I think that they're planning to walk off officially, you know, in the next 3 weeks or so. So we've got a few more weeks to potentially work this out. We'll see what happens, but it's, I agree.
Well, does this call into question the whole issue of PPPs, public-private partnerships, that Governor Hogan has been pushing for? He also wants to use it on the widening of I-270 and 495. How would you like to see the state handle these major projects going forward?
No, I think it does, and it's something that, frankly, like, well, I'm wholly opposed to the 495 expansion, and it shows that the state really does need to play a central role in the future on the Purple Line project, and then also in Baltimore City, the Red Line. These are state investments that need to be, you know, run and overseen by our state government, so that there's accountability and real invest and strategic investment. So this is what happens when you have a P3. They sound great in theory, and we've seen what the end result can be. So this isn't the end of the book yet. We're still in the process. So a few more weeks, we'll see what happens. But I think you make a fair point with the role that the state should have played here in the Purple Line, and then certainly with the Red Line.
Tom Sherwood.
The politics of this is that Governor Hogan, who opposed it when he ran for the Purple Line, when he ran for office, and then gutted funding, state funding for it when he got into office, as best I can tell, and I just checked online, Governor Hogan hasn't said a word about the Purple Line collapsing at this point. His officials have, but he has not. So I'd like for you to address that, maybe the Governor Hogan's silence. But also, I want to go back briefly to the police reform, because the police officers' Bill of Rights, which affects lots of police officers and state officials, there's some proposals to actually cancel that, to just repeal it completely, or just to fix it. Can you tell us if you're looking towards fixing it or repealing it? But first, Governor Hogan's silence.
Sure. Well, Governor Hogan's silence is deeply troubling, especially amidst some of the other turmoil that's kind of engulfed his administration as of late, but in terms of the fiscal management of his house. So this is deeply troubling, and especially when he played such an outside role in opposing the Purple Line initially, and then refusing to really invest those state dollars in a project that's going to be, it's going to help the economic, I mean, the DC, Maryland, Virginia area, the Prince George's County, Montgomery County, were really the economic engine for the state. And this would have infused more vitality, if you will, and ability in terms of tax revenue that would be generated. So I thought it was really short-sighted, and the fact that he's being quiet now is not unsurprising, but it's also very disappointing. With respect to the
Bill of
LEOBR, for
police officers?
Yes, the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights has been in Maryland's statute since 1974. It's the first in the nation discipline and due process piece of the statute. And so a lot of the conversation is centered on whether we're going to work within the statute or repeal it.
So the
conversation for me is not whether we repeal it or work within, but what do you replace it with? So, you know, for me personally, would love to see a repeal and then a replacing with a framework that raises the bar for discipline and due process throughout the state of Maryland, and preempts local collective bargaining agreements and their ability to collectively bargain for things that run afoul of the public interest, like disciplinary records and the disciplinary procedures that are implemented. So, for instance, in Montgomery County, the collective bargaining agreement allows for the review board of officer misconduct to be comprised of, you know, someone from the chief selection, someone from the officer section, and someone from mutually agreed upon. That is essentially a veto for that officer, so you don't really get an independent review of that conduct. These are the things that happen in the most progressive county in the state. So you can see where I'm going here, why we need a uniform standard and we need preemption. So, you know, working with our partners, we're developing what that framework would look like. And I think that's where we need to go. I'll just say very quickly that in Maryland, we have 148 law enforcement agencies. And if you repeal the LEOBR, the default position goes back to whatever they have on the books. So that's why it's important to have a uniform standard of discipline and due process that does not benefit officers, you know, more so than any other government employee. But you have to be keenly focused on what comes next. And I think that's where the conversation is now. And I'm happy to see that. So I'm glad we got started early.
Where did your committee come down on the issue of no-knock warrants, which has become very prominent since the police killing of Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky? I know that your panel was considering a bill to eliminate them, no-knock warrants. Where did you come down? Where did it come down?
Well, obviously, very disappointed with the verdict there, and happy to see that the protests have been, you know, have been peaceful and largely peaceful. And so I think it goes to some of the action we need to take here in Maryland. And so for me personally, I think they should be eliminated. And because there aren't situations in which I can see that, you know, there are obviously so many exceptions already. If you eliminate them as a whole, there are exceptions, like, you know, exigency exceptions, that can be, you know, made for a no-knock warrant. But, it's something that in Maryland, we had a very, I think, vigorous discussion about it yesterday, for me, I'm looking forward to eliminating that prospect in the future.
We got an email from Sylvia who says, I just heard in your introduction today that people can vote in Montgomery County online. I have an eligible voter stranded overseas and working on getting his ballot to him. It would be a lot easier if he could vote online, even if someone has to transfer the information to a ballot. Is that a possibility? We said in our billboard that if you voted online in Maryland, then the machine wouldn't be able to scan your ballot, that an election worker would have to do that himself or herself.
So that's interesting. To my knowledge, you can request your mail-in ballot online, but voting online is not something I'm familiar with in Maryland. But you can certainly request your mail-in ballot. You can print it out and then you know put it in the mail. There are a couple of key deadlines that everyone needs to be aware of. Obviously, October 13th is the last day you can register to vote. You've got to put your mail-in ballot. It's got to be received by October 20th. So that's another one. And then obviously we've got election day on November 3rd. So a couple key dates, but in terms of online voting, not familiar with that, but I am familiar that you can print out your mail-in ballot online. So you can receive that online.
Tom Sherwood, we only have about a minute left.
Very quickly, you said at the end of the hearing yesterday that there's still work to do. When will the public actually see another chance to weigh in? And when will we see draft bills that will be going toward to the legislature? How quickly will we see the draft bills you guys approve?
Got about 40 seconds left, Senator Smith.
Sure. So one thing is we had actual draft bills of legislation that we were working on. Those are available on the MGA website. So now it's to the sponsors of those bills. So Senator Carter, who's been working on these issues for, you know, decades, and then Senator Sidnor from Baltimore County, they will go out into the communities, stakeholders, get feedback, refine the legislation, and we hope to have it available a few weeks before we get back into session.
Okay, and that's about all the time we have. Will Smith is a member of the Maryland State Senate representing District 20 in Montgomery County. Senator Smith, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Up next is Mary Che. She's a D.C. council member representing Ward 3. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back. Joining us now is Mary Che. She's a D.C. council member representing Ward 3. She's also a constitutional law professor at the George Washington University School of Law. Council member Che, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, and hello to you both.
Tom Sherwood, before we get to the District of Columbia, either witnesses are not needed for absentee voting in Virginia, or they are. People have been getting instructions that apparently say both things.
Well, hell if I know. I can't figure out. In Virginia, there, as several media people report, including Julie Carey of NBC4, is that some people were getting in Fairfax County of duplicate ballots and then some differing instructions. whether you needed the witness, how you signed it, what you do or what you don't do. You know, we've had issues in the District of Columbia on balloting, and everyone's being mailed a ballot now for the November 3rd election. And, of course, Maryland's had its troubles. I think uniquely, this is a country that's, which I think President Trump is trying to exploit. There are so many jurisdictions trying to do mail balloting and get people to vote because of the virus by absentee in some form. It's a horrible mess, and unfortunately, I don't see anything getting better before and after November 3rd.
I hear you. Councilmember Che, before we get into D.C. politics, I'd like to ask you about Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died last week at the age of 87. You had the honor of being sworn into office by Justice Ginsburg. I'm assuming you requested that. Why? And what was that experience like?
Well, you know, I knew Justice Ginsburg professionally. We had served on some committees together, and she had been a law professor. And I also found out at some point that she had, believe it or not, actually read some of my law review articles and even sent me a note about one. And so we had a kind of a modest connection, but I thought a good one. And I was always in awe of her and her career. And so you know this, Kojo and Tom, that when you're sworn in, the mayor or the members of the council, at that ceremony, you have to go out and find your own judge. And so I thought I'd drop her a note, and I asked her if she'd be willing to swear me in, and she said, of course. So that's how that happened. The one feature of it that is amusing in retrospect, it was amusing at the time, but as the two of you also know, the judge is supposed to walk up with you and administer the oath, and then that's it. And then the person actually speaks, and the judge goes away. Well, we were on the end, and we were called up. And on the way up, you know, she was kind of frail and very, very soft-spoken. She said to me, she said, Mary, would you mind if I say a few words about you? And I said, Justice Ginsburg, you can do whatever you want. And neither before nor after have judges actually, you know, spoken beyond administering the oath. But, I mean, it was so thrilling. You know, it's hard to describe it. And then for her to embellish it this way by saying nice things about me, I mean, I was over the top happy. So, yes, she did swear me in.
I looked for video for that.
And did you find any?
I could not find the video, but I will. We should note that it was not the first time a Supreme Court justice has sworn someone in. In 1975, Justice Thurgood Marshall swore in the chairman of the council, Sterling Tucker, as the first chairman of the elected city government. And of course, Thurgood Marshall made a return appearance in 1979 when he swore in then the first term Marion Barry. So Mary Chase, I guess, is in good company.
Well, there's those who should know that that Justice Ginsburg was a specific trailblazer for the likes of Mary Che, because Justice Ginsburg was the first Harvard Law School class to admit women, and Mary Che also studied law at Harvard. So there's another connection there. But moving on to politics, this week the D.C. Council passed Vision Zero, legislation aimed at eliminating traffic deaths. You're chair of the Transportation and Environment Committee. D.C. adopted its first Vision Zero plan in 2015, but somehow traffic deaths are actually up. What's different in this legislation?
Well, you know, we try to keep identifying things that might improve the situation. And so it's an omnibus bill. There are a lot of pieces to it. And it ranges from, you know, requiring sidewalks to be on both sides of a street if there's a construction, major construction. It limits right on red, because we found that there are some issues about turning right on red where a driver may not see a cyclist or a pedestrian. And, you know, there's that interval there that's supposed to let the pedestrian or the cyclist get a head start so that they can be seen. But even still, there have been issues with right on red. there's a piece of this that codifies something that I started years ago. I asked DDOT to give me statistics on the worst intersections in terms of injuries or deaths or collisions. And I would have site visits and go out there and, you know, we'd invite the ANC people and the community and whatever and say, well, what are the problems out here? What can we do short term, long term? And then DDOT ran with that for a while and was doing it on its own. And then this bill codifies that, you know, to try to identify where are the problems. And we've increased, and I know, Tom, you'll love this. We've provided for increasing automatic traffic enforcement via red light cameras and speeding cameras and stop sign cameras and cameras to check and see whether people are violating those special dedicated lanes for buses. There's a whole lot in here, but the idea is that it's a package trying to identify more things that we can do, because you're right, Kojo, the effort has not only to this point been not successful, but it has sort of backtracked in terms of the number of deaths and injuries that we have on our roads. So, you know, we're trying to figure out what to do, and this is a bunch of things that were thought to be possibly improvements.
Before I get to Tom Sherwood, we have a listener, a caller, who is particularly concerned about this. Pat in D.C., you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so much, Kojo. Hello, council member. I appreciate the words you just said about what you're doing for Vision Zero, but I remain concerned. You've been spending a lot of time cracking down on scooter use in the district, and we've already passed the number of pedestrian deaths due to drivers compared to 2019. Why are you so concerned about scooter use in the district and not protecting pedestrians from dangerous drivers in the city? Thank you.
Councilmember
Che. Well, the premise of the question, I don't think is correct. It makes it seem, okay, you're myopically focusing on scooters and coming down on scooters. No, you have to take a holistic approach. If I could wave a wand and have what I would most desire, it would be that pedestrians would have the sidewalk, cyclists and scooters would have their protected path, and cars would have theirs. We have to separate the users. But the effort now has to be, you know, aiming toward that, but to do things in the meantime, you know, to make everybody safer. It's designed to make everyone safer. And with respect to scooters, I did have a hearing recently, and I am moving a bill, but the issue is not a singular issue. It's all of a piece.
Tom Sherwood?
Well, you know, that caller kind of stole my question. I was going to ask what some people are calling the scooter lady, but I'll move on. Mm-hmm. You know, council member, we're going to solve the car-bike battles right after we solve global warming. But the mayor has done something recently which a lot of drivers in the city don't seem to know about, and that's that the miles per hour in the city has been reduced from 25 to 20. Except where it's noted otherwise. How much of this car war stuff do you think the council should be doing? Obviously, we're a crowded area. Charles Allen, the Ward 6 council member whose bill this was, says this is just the start to get control of the streets so that we don't have the kind of 1950s mindset that everything is for a car.
Well, as I said before, you know, we have to provide for each user. Each is entitled to have access, you know, to our public spaces, but we have to protect all of them, because this intermixing without protections for each group, and, you know, the cyclists, the scooter riders, the pedestrians, they're the vulnerable users. And so, you know, we have to keep them uppermost in our mind. And in that regard, the lowering of the speed limit has that in view, because there's data that shows that, you know, for each additional mile or 5 miles of speed, if there is a collision between, let's say, a car and a pedestrian or a car and a cyclist, it enhances, which is probably not the word, it aggravates the injuries and perhaps leading to death. So the thought behind that was, in a dense urban area with multiple users, that to bring the speed down on some of the smaller roads, not obviously highways or other major roads, that would potentially be among the things that we're doing to minimize injury and death.
Okay, let me just very quickly note, you mentioned my name when you said there's going to be more automated
yes,
traffic
I
enforcement.
Did.
And I want to just say people should know that I actually support all of the more automated traffic enforcement. In this city, there's plenty of clear warnings, or it should be if there's not, on the streets where these cameras are. So mm-hmm. if you're speeding, you're going to pass by warning signs before you get a ticket.
Councilmember Che, Mayor Bowser said she wants to give all D.C. students the option to return to in-person school by November 9th, and she said she wants to bring small groups of students back into schools by the end of September. We got a tweet from one listener who says, as a DCPS school nurse, bringing children back into the school during cold and flu season and a pandemic is terrifying. This is irresponsible and negligent of Mayor Bowser. Children, while not as strongly, are affected by the virus and certainly can transmit it to adults. You signed on to a letter with three other council members asking the mayor to provide details on specific steps the district will take to reopen schools. What details do you want the government and DCPS to provide before students return to school?
Well, you know, there has to be safety and the health of the students and the staff, everyone involved to be assured, and that all of the people who may be involved, whether it be nurses or teachers or the students themselves, the parents, we have to have confidence that what we're doing makes sense. And even though, the mayor, and by the way, I think the mayor has been very cautious and careful in general with respect to dealing with the health crisis. So I would expect her to continue that, in terms of schools. But the discussion about returning to schools without giving the council, which is predicate of that letter to her, but also the residents, more importantly, the basic information about what's being done. For example, I always have these school readiness tours that I conduct before the start of school. I go to the schools, I look at all of the facilities, talk to the people involved. This time I did it virtually, and I had two things that I focused on with the principal and the other, school officials. One was, are we ready for virtual learning? Do we have the hardware and the software, et cetera? But the second was, to the extent that we do return to school, maybe even as early as November, do you think your facility is ready? And I found out some things that were quite disturbing. For example, there was one school which has all of its windows nailed shut. Okay, you can't even open the window. And then there were concerns about the HVAC systems, which may not have been operating so well anyway. And now we're going to put students in school without having assurances about proper ventilation. And then, of course, there are the physical changes. Would we have plexiglass set up between rows of students? I had asked on one of the mayor council calls, why couldn't we plan for more outdoor education? And I know the weather will change, but we could have tents and heaters and things of that nature, and it would be in the open air. I was told, well, the principals have to come up with a plan, each of them for their school, and it has to be within the building. If they want to do something outdoor, that's an add-on, and, we'll see about that. But there's no clear answer to whether we'd actually be ready to have students, and we're talking about perhaps 6 weeks from now. And I'm telling you, I hear from parents, I hear from constituents, and I hear from teachers. There's great anxiety there, great anxiety. And so that letter was part of an effort to prompt the executive to say, maybe they have the most wonderful plans in the world. I don't know. That's the problem. We don't know. And so we need to know. We need to have the details. They need to be publicly available and understood. Otherwise, people will lack confidence in sending their children back to school.
Tom Sherwood?
Well, Madam Council Member, I don't think I heard you. Maybe you did, and I was distracted for a moment. I don't think I heard you say Chancellor Farabee's name. Did you and I miss it? I mean, he's the head of the schools. Isn't he letting the council members and various organizations know what they're doing? Where is he?
Well, you know, we copied him. And so, of course, you know, he's a key player here, of course. And so,
you have a telephone. You could call him.
We want answers and we want the plan. You know, when I did my virtual readiness tours and I did speak to school officials, they said, well, you know, we have heard from the Department of General Services that they'll be coming by to assess things. And even at that point, you know, which was earlier, it was a promise that they're coming by. Here's the thing. If you need a major overhaul of your HVAC system, you can't do that in a day. That's going to take, you know, some time. If you need to make physical changes at the schools, you know, what are we asking the Department of General Services to do? I'm feeling quite insecure and perhaps just reflecting, you know, parents and teachers' approach to this. But you know, because my children are grown and, you know, I don't have to directly face the choice, but I'm just worried for those who do that they don't have enough to give them confidence that everything will be in order.
I think you're right that the mayor and the whole administration is under tremendous pressure to get so many things right about the virus, and they're doing some really good work around the city. But it just seems to me that Chancellor Louis Farabee should be a little more public about what's happening. If the mayor wants to open schools in any way, he should be out publicly letting us know what's happening.
Here is Maura in Washington, D.C. Maura, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I just would like to see everybody have more of a can-do attitude about this. I mean, everybody. The council, the mayor, Farabee, teachers, parents. We have to get kids back to school. We have to do it sooner rather than later. So let's stop the nitpicking and just figure it out and do it. Like other cities are doing it. We can do it too.
Maura, I suspect that's easier said than done, but allow me to have Mary Chair respond.
Well, Maura, I agree with you. I would love to have our children back in school. We know that especially kids who are struggling in any event are going to be left further behind. But the point about this is, and forgive me, but I don't regard it as nitpicking. All I'm saying is that in order to get the kids back in school, we need to have a plan, a good plan, one that we can have confidence in, and it needs to be communicated to parents and teachers so that they understand how it's going to work. That's all I'm saying.
Maura, thank you very much for your call. Councilmember Che, former city administrator Rashad Young was fined $2,500 for his involvement in brokering a deal with Howard University while in talks with the university for a job. What do you think about all of this, this decision, which comes from the D.C. Board of Ethics and Government Accountability? I guess the point was made that the former city administrator, according to the order, inadvertently committed a technical violation when he rejected amendments to increase the tax rate on July 14th, hours after the university president spoke to him about creating a job for him. Seems pretty messy, doesn't it?
Well, it's actually quite messy. And, you know, you talk about a technical violation. I wouldn't quite, treat it that way. It's true that there was no quid pro quo, and that would be the worst case scenario. Give me a job, I'll help you out with your tax situation. So that wasn't the case. But top administrators, including the city administrator, should know, and I think Councilmember Silverman said this at the time. She said, this is ethics 101. You do not engage with an entity for a job at the same time you're involved in an arrangement whereby the city is going to do something for that entity. I think anybody should know that. So when you say a technical violation, that's not a technical violation. And even though there was no quid pro quo, apparently, It's an obvious straight up violation, and it doesn't, you know, inspire us to think that, you know, people are aware of what their ethical violations are.
What do you think about the $2,500 fine?
I think there had to be something, because after all, it was a violation, and it's actually quite stark, a kind of a violation, and folks like the city administrator, being at the top of the executive service, if he doesn't know what would be a violation, then we better get some better training, because it seems almost self-evident.
Can I add one? Let me just add to this. The action that he took is interesting. At the same time he was being offered the job, the Howard University asked the city to grant it something like $80 million+ more in tax breaks.
Mm-hmm.
And the city administrator turned that request down, thinking that was the right thing to do, when, of course, the right thing to do was that since he was involved in a job negotiation, he should not have said one way or the other. Right? They're saying yes to those tax breaks or no. And I think that's where the fine came. And it's called kind of technical. Because if he had given Howard University an $80 million additional tax break, I think just it would have been terrible. Can we move on to another quick question?
Sure.
All right. And the Capitol Hill Church has sued the city because it says in the COVID crisis here in town, the city is allowing public protests, hundreds, thousands of people to gather in unsafe conditions. But their church on Capitol Hill, I think it's the Baptist Church, they cannot have their parishioners come to worship. What is your thoughts about that as a lawyer? Why can't people go into their church if they want to? Maybe they should call it a protest and just go into the church?
That's an interesting idea. You're thinking like a lawyer. Find a different way. The issue about how far mayors or heads of executive departments, whether they be governors or what have you, can go in terms of emergency orders for the pandemic has been litigated. There's been one court, one federal district court, that said, some of these closures are not reasonable, and therefore they shouldn't be applied. But I think most courts that have taken up these things about mayoral power or governor's power have upheld them because the emergency is of a nature that it would justify, give a compelling justification for the things that are put in place. Having said that, the issue that you raise is one of treating fairly different groups. And, the idea about the protests, the approach that the executive has taken is to say, look, we want to encourage people to socially distance. We want to encourage people to wear masks and, take these other steps. But what we don't want to do is we don't want to have confrontation and potentially, violence and that sort of thing to make sure that they're wearing their masks and keeping socially distant. And so what we're going to do is we're going to try to do the best we can to encourage them to behave in a sensible, appropriate way. And I think, for example,
the Civil Rights March was pretty
successful in that regard.
I think so. I do have to interrupt, though, because we're running out of time very quickly, and I need to know this. The D.C. Council signaled its initial approval of making the big brown bat D.C.'s official mammal.
Yeah.
Do you have any reservations about these small creatures representing
the
district?
I'm losing your – I can't hear you. I heard something about the big brown bat, which is something.
Do you agree with it being D.C.'s official mammal?
Yes. This was something that it bubbled up from these Girl Scout troops, and Charles Allen wanted to satisfy them.
Okay.
My question was, what about the little brown bat? And
I'm afraid we're out of time, Mary Jane. We don't have enough time. Today's show is produced by...
What happened?
Coming up Monday, a recent federal court ruling further threatens temporary protected status for immigrants. We'll talk about that. And video game designer Andrew Phelps joins Kojo for Kids to explain the art and science behind the games kids love. That all starts at noon on Monday. Until then, you, Tom Sherwood, have a wonderful weekend. Everyone else, you do the same. Stay safe. I'm Kojo Nam.
Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Julie Deppenbrock, Sydney Grannon, Lauren Marco, Kurt Gardiner, and Richard Cunningham. Our managing producer is Inga-Lisa Schrobsdorf. Our engineers are Mike Kidd and Rashad Young. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.